You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Wow, here we are, Nick. Episode number 18 of the Doolanders. How are you, mate?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I am absolutely fantastic. Hey, I was doing a little bit of homework over the course of the last couple of weeks around, you know, how do we get more listeners? How do we get our stories out to more and more people? Because we've got some amazing people telling amazing stories of doing. And I looked at like what's the top 10 podcasts in Australia. There are so many podcasts that are focused on true crime.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Some of the top rating podcasts, they're all about true crime.
Have you listened to any of those at all?
No, it's not my thing.
I don't know what it is, but it certainly works in terms of the volume of people that love to hear that. So I had an idea.
Yeah, what's that?
Well, I was thinking we could change the Doolanders into the Truelanders.
Is this another dream sequence coming up?
I don't think it's...
No, stop!
Welcome to the Truelanders. On this episode, we will be joined by Sarah Bailey, advertising executive by day, crime writer by night, and an unbelievable and inspiring story. You'll find Sarah has an amazing relationship with time. She'll tell you...
Oh, that's it. I can't handle any more of this.
What do you think?
Well, it certainly is popular, but I'm not certain it's you.
I don't think it's us.
I like the podcast title, though.
Hey, mate, tell us a little bit more about Sarah.
Yeah, so Sarah Bailey, ad exec by day... Crime writer by night. there's some things that struck me about this story and the way that she tells it. I won't ruin any. You can get into it. So I guess her personality type and the way that she, from a very young age, was into lists and making lists and checking things off, but also her attitude towards doing and not doing. It, you know, great for this podcast, obviously. You know, something's there, you can do it. And she has and we'll talk about this after the episode, but her relationship with time, and there's a lot in there, I think, for our listeners to get out of that, of how to best use snippets of time.
Yep, sure is. Without any further ado, because Sarah tells her story so much better than we do. Here's Sarah Bailey.
Blake, do you like stories of people doing...
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say, do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Sarah Bailey, welcome to the Doolanders. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me, Nick and Blake.
Yes, that's a success.
There it is, Blake.
I'm glad you recognise Nick, Sarah. He has been left out in the past. Hey, Sarah, you are a managing partner in the advertising industry. You're an author and best-selling crime writer, and I'll come to what does best-selling mean. Co-parenter. Hey, tell us, how do you fit all of this doing into your life?
One thing at a time is kind of the easy answer to that question. I think it helps if all of the things that you're trying to fit in are things that you want to fit in. So I've made a fairly conscious decision to pair my book writing with my work, and I decided that if I was going to try to do that, I really needed to personally work out how I was going to manage it. And it's not really anyone else's sort of job to manage that, I guess, but mine. I remind myself of that constantly when I'm writing up late at night or early on a weekend, that it's all my fault. And therefore, I really can't kind of blame anyone else for that situation, and I just need to, you know, work through it. But I guess the other answer to your question is that I have juggled a lot of things for a long time, and I find that the things get done. And I think so now I've probably got more confidence in my ability to do things. And I think if you spend less time worrying about how you're going to do things and just getting on and doing them, that tends to work quite well for me also.
Yeah, that's interesting. We were talking, you know, prior to this, and you were talking about your, I guess, your relationship with time, right? And you were talking about pre-worry and after-worry and, how do you think about those things, or don't you think about those things?
Yeah, look, I've always been pretty good with time management. Like even as a little kid, I was someone that would kind of get up, get stuff done, organize myself, plan things out in my mind. I'm a massive list writer. I've had a to-do list going since I think I was like 7 or 8 years old. And I find it really helpful. Like if I lost my notebook, I would be lost. And it's never been digital for me. It has to be written down. I have to be able to cross it off. I write lists for work, for my books, for money management, everything in my life. So, I mean, I've always been organized, but I think I also made a bit of a deal with myself a few years ago where I just really decided to stop worrying about things that hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
I think I did hear it somewhere else on a podcast, so I shouldn't claim it as a philosophy, but I feel like a lot of my energy was going into worrying about things that hadn't transpired or might never transpire. And because I'm quite a bad sleeper, I found that a lot of my insomnia hours were spent sort of preempting conversations that I was going to have the next day. And when I got to work and would have them, they were so much less of a problem than I had anticipated them to be, that I would then just sit there and walk away going, I cannot believe I dedicated, you know, hours of my life to worrying about this run-in with somebody, and the actual sort of run-in was 5 minutes. And so I think that you have to go through that to kind of know that you can, you know, understand that that is not always going to be the case. But I did, yeah, really sort of decide to stop pre-worrying. I call it pre-worry. And I just tend to kind of go, well, let's just see what's going to happen, and let's invest all of that pre-worry energy into good strategies and being prepared so that hopefully the bad stuff doesn't happen. But if it does, then I'll have all this amazing energy stored up to really, really embrace that terrible incident or moment and, like, you know, lean into it.
I love it. This is a fascinating subject, and quite honestly, I could talk to you about this for hours, because, like, I reckon I spend half my life trying to stay present and not do the pre-worry or the post-worry and just deal with the moment. Like, did you just flick a switch and go, oh, I'm no longer pre and post worry or lie awake thinking about conversations I'm about to have or I have had? How did you make that happen?
I don't remember the exact kind of moment. So I'm sure it wasn't sort of a switch flick moment. But I just think there was a combination of things. Like, I guess I'd taken some time out of the advertising industry and I'd been writing, so like a lot more time on my own. I think I just, that distance perhaps created the ability to look back on it with a little bit more clarity. And then, you know, when I did go back into the work environment, I was much more mindful of other people's pre-worry. And when you're observing it in someone else, I think you're able to sort of say, hey, like, you don't need to worry about that yet. Let's, you know, do what we can to sort of avoid it. And then if we really need to worry about it, I'll help you and we'll worry about it together and it'll be fine. So I think it was just a bit of a stepping outside of the bubble and seeing things for what they were and realizing that I just didn't want to spend my time on that kind of negative energy or that it's almost like impotent energy. It kind of goes nowhere. But it does take up time. And I think the less time I had, I guess once I decided that I wanted to sort of do both write and you know, do advertising at the same time, I kind of had to work through what I could ditch, and that was what I could ditch, I think.
Yeah, well, that's great perspective. Hey, I just wanted to pick up on something you mentioned earlier, and that's your to-do list. You said that, and hey, these are your words and probably Nick's. No, they're your words. So you said in your letter, a dull but pleasant childhood. And you described yourself as an ambitious child and you had big dreams. So what was on that to-do list of big dreams?
Yeah, I don't have them, so don't worry. I can't pull them out and show you anything too embarrassing. But I guess by dull childhood, I probably should just be really clear. Like, I had a really lovely childhood. It was imaginative and supportive and all those things. My parents were, you know, really amazing people. Very encouraging of my sister and I, but there was no great fodder for my literature, I guess is the problem. You know, no dramatic kind of family secrets really, nothing particularly interesting to kind of draw upon. So I've had to really, you know, work quite hard to imagine all that stuff. But I definitely was the kind of kid that would set New Year's resolutions and, like, completely off my own bat too. Like, it wasn't, that wasn't something that we sat down and did. I just always liked the promise of a new year, promise of a new notebook, you know, like all of the sort of potential was always kind of really interesting to me. And I don't think I did anything as a kid that was particularly impressive, but I think I always really wanted to strive to do really well without letting it get in the way of having a really good time. So I've never been really very good at sacrificing one thing for another. I just want to do both. And I kind of structured my whole life around doing both. And I think I probably drove my parents crazy, to be honest, because it was frustrating for them. I think they were always kind of like, you're not going out until your homework's done. And I'd be like, fine. Here's my homework, I'm going out. It was hard, I think, in a way for them because they, you know, were relatively conservative and it was sort of a lot of like, well, you need to do this to be able to do that. And I was like, you want to play that game? We'll play that game. So I think, yeah, I was really good at saving money. You know, I guess I was always very focused on I wanted to buy a house, like I just wanted to do that. And that was something I wanted to do from a young age. I wanted to work full time throughout my exams at school, which no one was supportive of, but I was very keen to do that. And I did dabble kind of with the idea of writing books even back then, and I certainly didn't do anything sort of amazingly impressive like write one, but it was kind of something that I would think about quite a lot, and, you know, lots of short stories and little fiction pieces and things like that. So yeah, the ambition was sort of more in a drive to achieve things or kind of be productive, I guess.
How are you going? You're happy with your progress so far? Has it met your ambitious wants and needs?
If I'm really honest, I think that's a constant feeling. Like I'm pretty restless as a person, and that's not at all to mean that I jump around a lot. I'm actually really quite loyal. I mean, I was at my first job for 13 years, sort of on and off, really. So I don't flit around and kind of change things up for the sake of it. I'm quite loyal to people, cultures, and teams. But I constantly feel like I want to do more. And even, you know, even at the moment, like I'm bursting at the seams with busyness, but I have this weird sort of feeling sometimes where I'm like, oh, I want, what else could I do? And it's weird because if you sort of said, well, what would you do? I probably can't quite tell you, but there is this kind of, it's not quite like a feeling like I'm running out of time, but it's a bit like that. You know, I'm kind of like, what else can I make sure I'm targeting next? Like, I want to make sure I've got something I'm working toward. And all of the things I'm doing at the moment say a certain kind of part of that, but nothing ever fully feels full.
What are you like when you're sitting on the couch watching the TV? Are you just phone in one hand, book in another, absorbing some TV?
I don't ever just sit on the couch and watch TV, and that's honest. Like, I really struggle to just sit down and do one thing, and I think it's probably quite annoying, but I really, really struggle with that. And I, to be honest, I also can't separate it from, I have been on a deadline for the last few years, so maybe if I've not been on a writing deadline, I could, maybe that's, you know, would be a little bit different. But yeah, I don't enjoy doing one thing at a time. Like, the most stressful thing I can think of is doing meditation or yoga. Like, I just cannot bear the thought of having an hour where I just sit there and just do one thing and I can't achieve anything. The thought is so stressful to me, I would never do it. I've tried yoga quite a bit and I just always get halfway through and I'm like, oh, I can't just wait to get out of here and just get on with stuff. Like, this is just such a waste of my time. I'm sure it's all completely arse about, but yeah, it's just if I'm being truthful, that's how I feel about it.
I think the yoga instructor needs to give you certain deadlines. So at a minute, make sure that you can see your mind's eye at the 2-minute mark, blah, blah, blah. Hey, that's really fascinating. And look, I think it'll probably give us some insight into, you know, the next question. So I'd love you to, you know, tell our listeners why you do what you do, and perhaps we could start with writing. Like, is it something that you have to do? Is it innate? Does it spill out of you? Why do you do it?
I think it's a real honor to create something out of nothing. Like, it is genuinely a pretty pure, joyful pastime to make a story and to keep finessing that story for so many hours, and create like a layered world of characters. And there is a satisfaction and like a genuine kind of pleasure in the process of doing that. Not the whole time, like 100% admit that there is moments where I want to chuck my laptop against the wall. And it's really hard work, but there is other moments where, you know, you're on a bit of a roll and you can tell it's all coming together, and you almost forget that it's a story. Like, I have moments where I'm like, oh, of course, you know, that works with that, and that's the gap in that chapter, and you're almost the book's beyond you. Like, I couldn't stop and actually think about it properly. It's too complicated by that point, but my brain has taken over, and luckily it remembers more than me. So I would say that there's a sort of like a primal sort of satisfaction in the process of it. But I think the validation piece is probably the bigger driver. If someone said to me, you will work on this book and you will not finish it, I personally don't have an interest in that. You know, I'm in it for the completion moment.
For the outcome.
The outcome. And yeah, when I wrote, obviously, my first book, The Dark Lake, there was no guarantees whatsoever, and I didn't know if I would A, finish it, or B, anyone would want to read it, or, you know, pay to read it. And I took a massive punt, I guess. And probably in that particular process, I was happy just to go through the motions of writing the book, because I just wanted it out. I wanted to have done it for myself, and that was really important to me at that point in time. But now, I mean, it's definitely changed. Like, I wouldn't want to go through the process of writing a book if it wasn't going to result in a book. And then, you know, the holding of the book at the end of that slog is like better than holding your kids when they're born. And I've told them that so they won't be offended. But there is so much.
Wow.
There's so much more work involved in what you've done to get a book to that form And you know it like in and out to the point of you almost can't, it's almost, you know it so well that by the time it's in that form, you look at it and you almost don't know it. It feels so foreign because of what you've gone through together that you're almost like, get it kind of away from me. It's too much. But it's also like, I think, pretty addictive. I don't think it ever gets old to have completed something and for it to be done and for your name to be on it. Like, it's pretty amazing. Whereas I think the kids grow on you over time.
Yeah.
So it's like a bit, yeah. It's like the opposite.
So just on that, I think it was George Lucas, I'm going to go with it anyway, who said that, well, films in particular, and I'm sure it's similar to a lot of creative things, they're never finished, they're abandoned. And that is that kind of how it feels when you get to a point in the book and you just go, I guess this is as good as I can make it, or, you know, the deadline's hit. How does it feel to actually finish that?
I understand that comment, but I think I'm quite lucky in that I'm not a perfectionist. Like, I'm really not. I'm very much a done is better than perfect kind of person. And I'm under no illusions either that the books that I write aren't high art and, you know, hopefully lots of people will read them, but it's not going to be the book of the year or anything like that. So I guess I don't agonize over it in a way that is sort of so fraught that by the time I'm finished with it, I'm sort of, I can't tinker with it anymore because my brain's broken. Yes, I'm over it. Yes, I'm tired of it. Yes, even while the file's loading for me to do final edits, I'm looking at the words and I'm like, oh, my God, I just can't be bothered. But I'm actually quite good at distancing myself from the book, and I don't – it could always be better, of course. There's probably always going to be a mistake in something I've written. Someone won't like it. But I don't feel that sort of absolute creative sort of – what's the word, like misery over it. I'm sort of quite I think my relationship with it's quite healthy. I'm like, I've done what I can. Everyone's relatively happy. It's good to go. It's time for that book to go, and I don't ever send it out and then go, oh, my God, I want it back to fix it. I'm like, no, it's done. So I think that is probably the commercial business part of my brain, which is what my job is based on. I think I work with a lot of creative people that, you know, are much more in that sort of mode of craft, tinker. And I'm like, guys, there's a deadline. We've got to get it to the client. We've got to go. It's fine. It's good enough. So I'm probably a bit more, I'm wired that way, I think.
Get it out the door, because there'll be another deadline for something else shortly that you'll need to put your energy and time into.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Hey, you're a best-selling crime writer, I hear, in Australia, the USA and Canada. What does best-selling mean?
It's a very good question. So a very quick overview of the book market. In Australia, there is about, I think, 20 books that sell more than a certain number of copies, and it's something like 20,000.
Right.
And then there is thousands of books that sell under that.
Yep.
And the majority of them sit under like 2,000 copies. So it's a really long tail market. Most books that are published, you know, find their way into a couple of hands of readers. It's not a highly lucrative industry for a number of reasons. Like the art takes a long time to make. So straight away you've got a bit of a problem just from an input versus kind of output perspective.
Yeah.
So I'm very, very lucky to be sitting kind of in the middle of that chart, and crime does well anyway, generally speaking. And there's weird pockets of success too, like some of the romance, Kindle version only, they sell thousands and thousands of files, you know, downloads or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's just the amazing runaway success stories that sell, like the Barefoot Investor guy who sold like 100,000 copies of his books, you know,
on a monthly basis. Yeah, that's right. It's crazy.
So yeah, bestseller, I think someone told me once that the technical kind of criteria is like, if you sell over 8,000 books in Australia, you're a bestseller. And my book, my first book's been out for a couple of years now. So it sold really well. Like I was really, really lucky with that first book. And then, you know, the second one didn't do as well. The third one has done better than the second so far for no real kind of reason. So it's just, it is a bit of a luck game, I think. And I was very, very lucky that it got picked up overseas because obviously from a economy of scale perspective, you write one book and all you want is to get that book out into as many markets as possible. Because if you don't have to recreate it, but more people can read it, that's where you actually can kind of make some money, really. Australia is pretty small, you know, from an audience perspective.
So with the digital markets that are there, and you mentioned Kindle, how tempting is it in this day and age to self-publish versus going through a publisher? Like, is it actually worth your while if you sell enough books?
It can be really profitable, and I know there's a couple of people that have done really, really well out of going down that path. I did self-publish a book of short stories a few years ago. That was kind of my warm-up, I suppose, to all of this. And look, I didn't do it properly and I didn't do it seriously, so it's not the best test case, but I found that process pretty convoluted and a little bit unscrupulous in terms of who you're dealing with, and I don't feel like you really get a good read on whether or not you're actually selling any copies or not. So I think I would do it very differently if I was going to do that again. But I also think too that the safety net of a big publisher is just, it's so, they do everything for you, they have all the contacts, they know what they're doing. You know, it is incredibly easy once you're in that world. I think it'd be very hard to go back again. But there's certain kind of niche markets and genres, you know, people that have an audience who wouldn't necessarily be going to bookstores or whatever. Like, if they can find those people sort of in a really specific way, I can very much see the temptation, or, you know, if someone's got 50,000 followers on Instagram and that's almost like their ready-made audience, well, you cut out, you know, all the expensive people. Sure, I think that makes a lot of sense. But for someone like me, I don't think that would really make a lot of sense from what I know.
Sure. So you give birth to this book. You look at it, you look at your child, you look at the book, you look at the child, you think, I love this book even more than my child. And you have a whole bunch of people that you've never met but have read your stuff, and they're writing reviews about your work. Do you read those reviews, and how do you feel and compute those reviews?
So I always used to read the reviews quite religiously, and I think this is a pretty common pattern of behaviour, so I don't think this is a huge admission. But when my first book came out, there's like about 6 weeks before it's published that a lot of people in the book industry have proof copies. So you actually get sort of this weird pre-launch time frame where people are like tagging you on Twitter and, you know, copying you on Instagram and saying, read this book, and then they tell everyone what they think about it. I think, again, I was probably quite fortunate because debut author, there was like my publisher was really supportive. There'd been lots of kind of advertising around the book and hype around the book in the industry. And I think hype is quite strange because it's sort of a bit self-fulfilling. It can either be, I guess, people go, oh, what a letdown, like I hated that book even though everyone said I was going to love it, and they can be kind of angry about it. But I think generally speaking, if there's goodwill toward like a debut book, then people are quite excited for you. So I felt like I had this wave of pretty positive reviews, like lots of 4-star comments and, you know, loved it and blah, blah, blah. So I was kind of scared to wake up every morning though, because your phone would be filled with like comments and, you know, tags and stuff. And then once it actually kind of goes live and it's published, then you get the Goodreads comments. And Goodreads, someone joked to me once that if you're an author, If you type G-O-O into your search filter, Goodreads comes up, not Google. You're on that so much, and it's absolutely true. But that's a place of intense evilness in terms of what people are willing to say about books. And it's a bit disheartening because they are book lovers. Like, if you've got a Goodreads account, you're a book lover. So it is a bit confronting when people are like absolutely scathing, one stars, I hate this book. But I think what I really quickly discovered was my book's quite polarizing because the main character's quite polarizing. So I would tend to either get one-star reviews and everyone would say how much they hated her, or I'd get five-star reviews with people saying how much they loved her. So I kind of, in the way, just went, well, it's really just around a 3.5. Like, it's kind of neutral, really. And, you know, more people liked it than didn't, and it was selling really well. So I was kind of like, I don't really mind if people are buying it and they hate it. Well, at least they've given, you know,
handed over. Bought it.
Exactly. And, and also, sometimes the reviews were amazing. Like, they'd be really constructive. So even if they were negative, I would read them going, that's actually a really good point. Like, I really should have thought of that. And, you know, reading what people find annoying was kind of interesting. So I didn't ever feel offended by a review. I get lots of emails too, like lots of direct emails from my website. So people are always really happy to tell you what they didn't like about your book. And they tend to be the ones that email, so that's, you know, it's a bit strange. But I think the years in advertising probably did harden me up a little bit too, because I've really never read a review that has been on my mind for more than 5 minutes. It just doesn't stick. Whereas I do know some other kind of writing friends who really take them to heart, and it really, really, really bothers them. And it causes a lot of self-doubt when they're sitting down to write other books. I just don't really feel that way. I kind of go, you can only write what you want to write, and if people don't like it, I mean, you know, you can't be writing with that in mind, I don't think. So I don't read the reviews anymore. I haven't been on Goodreads for, like, I don't know, probably a year.
That's probably a good way to be. It sounds like you're at least the central character evokes a fair bit of emotion with the readers, which is probably good that you're actually able to, you know, pull that much out of them. But on choosing a genre to go after, you went for crime, and unless this, I'm using air quotes here, dull childhood was really some sort of criminal empire that your parents were running with you, you and your sister doing, I don't know, some sort of drug running or something. How do you choose a genre that you don't have any personal experience with? Maybe you do. And then actually pick it apart. Because a lot of the time you hear about crime writers who might have been working in the police force or had something to do in that industry. Can you talk our listeners through how you choose something like that, why it's of interest? You know, it is very, even in podcast world, crime is huge. How do you choose it? Can you give some insight into that?
Sure. I mean, I definitely didn't. Consciously choose it is probably the first point. I really just kept coming up with ideas that had murder in them. So that was sort of by default crime, I guess. But I'd never sat down and kind of thought, oh, I'm writing a crime book, or I didn't even really think about the genre. I don't remember anyway until I was talking to my agent, you know, and she was talking about crime fiction or crime thriller or domestic crime thriller. And I was sort of, clearly I knew it was crime by that point, but I just had never really sat down and sort of thought about it specifically. I think why I kept coming up with concepts that were, you know, crime oriented, I guess you just get to explore the really extremes of human emotion, and crime is high stakes. You know, it's life and death, and it's dramatic in between, and you get to explore interesting versions of real life. You get to peek behind, you know, the kind of corners a bit more. And I mean, I think that people that work in the police force or, you know, journalism or whatever the kind of crime role in the stories that you're writing are, it's just a different take on life every day. And I find that fascinating. I mean, my mum works as a nurse at a hospital in like a management role, and obviously that's not crime, but even, you know, what she sees on a daily basis is just, it's pretty extreme and it's pretty primal versus I trot off to advertising, and it does feel really, really intense some days, and life or death it can certainly feel like also, but it's not. And you're still dealing with lots of human emotion, but it's just not, lives aren't on the line and people aren't making decisions that are going to impact the rest of their life. And I find that just endlessly, endlessly fascinating. And I guess it's kind of, it's really fun to create storylines that tackle those big questions and the motivations of people and what takes someone to the brink is interesting.
And because you're not living it, right? You're not living it. You don't work in it. How much research goes into, you know, doing what you're doing, writing what you write? Like Gemma, the main character, is a policewoman. Like, have you had to spend hours, weeks, months researching in order to get it right and believable?
The answer to your question is sort of, but I do it all afterwards. So I feel very strongly that the only way I could write a book is to just get writing it and to get the story happening in my mind first. I read an awful lot of crime. I watch an awful lot of crime, and I always have. And I read a lot of news sort of stories too, and, you know, really, and I don't just read them. I really kind of will often then look up sort of, well, what would that have meant and why would that have been the way that had to play out from a court point of view or whatever. So I think my basic kind of knowledge is not bad from a procedural perspective. And then, you know, with the stories that I have written so far, I've written them all, I guess, relatively hard and fast. I've fact-checked along the way, just desk research, like just basic sort of stuff to make sure the linear flow works. But then once the story's feeling good, I'll go back and test my own narrative. And I've said this to a few people before, like I think I'm not a good research kind of person. I would be so bored, like, and I'm so impatient. I can't imagine, like, people that say, oh, I did some sort of 3 months worth of research before I wrote a word. I'm like, I just do not understand that. That would never, I would drive myself crazy. So I just have to start writing the book. But I have to do a lot of rewriting because once I, you know, go through the motions of checking my facts and my storylines, I do sometimes kind of go, oh, can't do it that way and that's not plausible. But I tend to kind of use expert people to prove myself right rather than prove myself wrong. So I never go to somebody like a doctor or a police detective and say, what would you do in this instance? Because you're going to get like a big sort of ego-led, well, I would do it this way, and, you know, it's all going to be referenced based on something that they've done in the past. Whereas I tend to find that if I say, is this possible, yes or no, kind of get, it's a bit of a shortcut to answers as well. So,
like it. Hey, we've spoken a lot about your writing and what you do in your writing, but it's, you know, only part of what you do. You know, you describe another part of what you do, the advertising industry, as creative, commercial, and completely crazy, and that suits you perfectly. In what way? What do you mean?
I love ideas. I just think any industry that you get to go to work and you get to talk about ideas is pretty magical. I fell so in love with it, like when I started out, and, you know, accidentally stayed up until now, really. It drives me crazy sometimes, of course. You know, trying to pair creativity with commercial reality is no easy marriage. And I'm right in the middle, you know, in my role. So that's hard sometimes. But at the end of the day, I think working with incredible people, doing things as a team, I mean, it's the opposite of my book in the sense that it's just this team sport. Everyone plays a role. It's such an amazing kind of feeling making something with other people and then all sitting back and, you know, being proud together. That shared kind of validation is pretty special. And I really, really like managing teams of people. And I think I like, I find a lot of satisfaction in creativity that's not necessarily what we're making, but the way we're approaching a problem. Or, you know, we've got a difficult, tricky client. How are we going to manage that person in the most sort of successful way? So I kind of find satisfaction in the layers of advertising. Like there's the overall, you've got to make this massive number for the year, you know, 1st of January ticks on and go.
Yeah.
I have no problem with that and, you know, every month's sort of deadline and whatever. But I also really like the granularity of like this problem's cropped up. Let's work out how we're going to fix that. And, well, this person's wobbly. How are we going to try to, you know, convince them that they need to stay part of our amazing team? And all of the psychology involved in managing people while getting them to do stuff, it's super interesting, I think. And it's just a bonus that what we're doing is also interesting as well, you know.
It appears, you know, you watch all of the movies, TV shows that have ever been made about the advertising industry, it, you know, appears really glamorous and, you know, sexy, as they say. Is it?
It can be, but, I mean, I've spent the last 6 months, like, working from my kitchen table or my bedroom floor, so not the best time to ask me. But, yeah, I mean, there's moments of glamour, I guess, but it's more, I think, these days just that it's got that tech startup vibe, I think, more than anything else. You know, it's just amazing brains just walking around and then pairing up on certain projects, all focusing on the one problem and then disassembling and repairing with other brains to tackle the next problem. So, you know, it's not so much glamorous as just an amazing blend of, great thinking and a bit of magic and a little bit of science and a little bit of precedent, and it's all kind of rolled into weird alchemy every time we get a new brief. So it doesn't, it's repetitive, you know, by the nature of all kind of business is repetitive, but it does feel like you're constantly being challenged to think in different ways about different problems, which is pretty cool, I think.
How do you talked about the psychology of, you know, leading people, and how do you get the most out of people? Like, you know, you said there's this weird alchemy of, you know, tech talent, you know, digital nous, you're talking to analysts, and then you got creatives wandering around all over the place. And like, how do you tackle that? How do you get the most out of their doing?
I mean, look, I think probably the answer is sometimes I don't, but I try to be really honest. And I think, look, it's not a solo sport, like I said. So I guess I've got an amazing management team around me at the moment, and I think we're really aligned, and that helps a lot. So the five of us, you know, we all respect each other, and there's a real unified sort of vision and philosophy and an approach to how we manage people and how we tackle problems. And in terms of how we've created that, I couldn't tell you. I think it's just a combination of right people, right time, and a lot of honesty when we first started working together and settling into our swim lanes. But, yeah, taking that more broadly, I think I'm quite upfront with people. I don't waste conversation opportunities, I think. So if I've got something that's not working for me, I'll say why and try to get a resolution as quickly as possible. I've learned that being honest is just, it's not brave or anything like that. It's just a shortcut. It's just efficient. It's helpful for everybody involved, and everyone feels better afterwards. So I try to be quite sort of direct and clear. I really try to be clear, and I often say, is that clear? Have I explained it properly? Do we need to, like, go over that again? Because I think the worst thing is that everyone, you know, gets together, thinks that it's something's ticked off their list, and then everyone gets off the phone and they're all like, what? I don't know what? What are we doing? I don't like that. So I try to prevent me being the cause of that. And I try to prevent other people being the cause of it too by asking questions if I don't understand. And then just, you know, trying to make things really fun. I mean, I've said this 100 times before, but, you know, if we're going to work in advertising, like, it's got to be fun most of the time. And so I think me enjoying things and finding things funny and looking at the funny side of things often helps. Just even if something's annoying or frustrating or someone's not understanding it, it's like, you know, if you can kind of turn that into like, all right, they're not understanding it, so what are we doing wrong and how can we convey this in a better way? And I find that works on all accounts. My clients at the moment are pretty serious, government, you know, clients, Defence Force, and other sort of quite serious clients, but it's always still, there's always humour to be found in the way we work, and I think that is really, really important.
And do you take that same approach with your other teams? So if you think about the juggle, right, you've got to have crazy discipline to spit out the writing that you do. You've got this full-time career in advertising where you're meeting deadlines on a, you know, daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly basis. And then you've got your kids and, you know, you're co-parenting. How do you adopt that same pragmatic, honest, transparent approach with the kids?
I definitely try. The homeschooling has been a challenge.
Has it been the undoing of you?
No, it hasn't. Probably because I did sit them down at the start and I was like, this is going to suck pretty bad.
Yeah, good. Set the bar low. Yeah.
I said, look, it's not going to be forever. Some parts will be fun and funny. Other days, you know, I'm going to have to walk out of the room because I'm going to be very angry. I'm still trying to do a pretty important job and look after lots of other people. So we're all just going to have to work that out. And we have to reset that conversation and have it more than, like, probably about once a week we have to have it because everyone forgets. But I think it is an important conversation to have. And, yeah, I'm really honest with them. I tell them, like, if I'm finding my book really hard or if I get feedback from my publisher that really upsets me or throws me for a couple of hours, I'll just say, this is what's happened. And with work, I mean, they know everyone's names, and the benefit of them being at home now is that they know what everyone looks like because they see them in the video meetings every day. They know the org chart. They could recite that. They know, you know, different meetings and different people, and I have to be careful that they don't say things out loud that I've said. But, yes, they know all of, like, the dynamics, and I think they understand my role a lot more, which is kind of nice.
Great,
and
yeah.
I, you know, have had to revisit grade 2 maths, which has also been, something for me, beneficial maybe, I'm not sure.
Will you pass grade 2 maths? Or
say it's still up in the air at this stage, but I'm trying really hard. Yeah. So.
Well, I've failed, there's no doubt about that. Hey, I'm sure, you know, on a daily basis you're out there inspiring your team to do a whole, a whole bunch of stuff and to find I guess the best that they can do. When you look around your life and your career, you know, who's inspired you along the way in terms of, you know, how you go about doing things?
I mean, there is so many people that I find inspiring, but for really different reasons. In the book world, there's some writers that I just am absolutely blatantly jealous of, and I do find them inspiring. People that have managed to kind of sustain a career of, you know, writing for 2 decades is, I know how hard that is. And so I really admire that. In advertising, there's people that really inspire me, like people I've worked with definitely that have, you know, gone on to be even more amazing than when I worked with them. And again, sustaining a career in advertising for that long is not easy either. So I admire that a lot as well. The industry can get to you sometimes. So if you've managed to kind of stick it out for 30 years, then it's a credit to you. But I also just find people inspiring that have looked at something in a new way and made something of that. You know, weird little products that pop up that you just think, God, that's so clever. Like, how could anyone not have thought of that before? And probably so many people did, but they just didn't do anything about it. I mean, in terms of your whole podcast, like, I really rate people that just do stuff, because, you know, half-finished manuscripts on a laptop are not books. And I decided really, you know, early on that I didn't want to have a graveyard of half ideas on my laptop desktop. So I guess anyone that gets out there and finishes things and does things, I really have always admired. And then there's just the standard sort of, you know, the world leaders that seem to be able to balance leadership and empathy without it being too much of an effort or an inconvenience, you know, are always super impressive as well.
Yeah, without sitting there rocking in the corner, like, you know, running a country. What's on your to-do list from here?
I would like to write more books, but I probably have less of a deadline on that than I ever have before. I sort of don't mind now when that happens. But I'd, you know, I'd like to write at least one book that's not crime. I've got a couple of ideas, and I just need to sort of, you know, work out when the idea is ready to be downloaded from from the brain to the page. And, you know, currently looking kind of in the next sort of 12 months, I guess, there's lots of really clear goals that, you know, I'm doing with my team at work that are pretty kind of motivating. So I want to, you know, achieve those too. And then I guess, yeah, creatively, like it'd be really interesting, I think, to look at a different type of writing at some point. Like, I don't know, screenwriting, I have no idea how to do it, but I think that'd be pretty interesting. Maybe working with some other people, you know, collaboratively on some kind of creative project that mixes advertising and writing almost meets in the middle somewhere would be cool. And then, you know, with the kids, that's just an ongoing project, right?
The never-ending project.
Yeah, hoping that they, you know, keep being relatively impressive and stable would be a general goal. Harder to measure, I guess.
So just thinking about our listeners as we wrap up, what's your advice to people out there who want to live a double life like you, ad exec by day, crime novelist by night? They may not be writers. They might want to, you know, do anything, pick up a hobby, and doesn't have to be professional. What's your advice to those people out there with the half-written manuscript or equivalent? To give them, what would you say to them to help them get that off the ground?
Look, I think you have to just decide that you want to do it enough that you will do it. And I don't even think it's a case of having to carve out a specific amount of time per week or decide what you're going to give up and sort of map that all out. I think in a way all of that's potentially procrastinating. I think it works for some people, but I think you've just got to do it. My favorite writing tip that is my writing tip that I made up is turning the kind of thought of, oh, I only have 20 minutes into, I have 20 minutes, you know. And I think, I've written the book I'm writing at the moment, I've written in between, 7 and 7:30 in the morning. I've written it like 15-minute little blocks before work officially starts in the morning at the cafe near my office. I've written it, you know, Saturday mornings. Like, it's not, it's a bit messy and it's not the best, and I don't have like a beautiful big desk and, you know, 20 hours a week that I sit there. It's not maybe everyone's like vision of how you would write, but I think you can't fight it. I think when you try to fight it is when it doesn't happen. So for me, it's just been a case of going, I really want to write. I also want to work in advertising. I'm the only person that cares if I do both. Like, literally no one else cares. So if I want to do both of those things, I kind of just got to do it and try not to complain about it because I decided to do it. So I think there's always more time in the day than you think, especially if you don't keep thinking about how much time you don't have in the day.
That's great advice.
Cracking advice. Hey, Sarah, we're really grateful for you taking the 55 minutes out of your really busy schedule to spend some time with us and tell us your tale of doing. So thank you again. It's been amazing.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Blake.
Oh, yes. Doubled. Thanks, Sarah.
It was great to chat to you guys too.
A to-do list at 7 years old. That's unbelievable.
It's pretty amazing.
You're a list maker. I'm a list maker. When did you start writing lists?
It took me quite a while. I think I was in fourth year uni by the time I worked out that I needed lists to actually manage my time a little better. Certainly not anything like seven. I don't know what I was doing at seven.
Yeah, I'll tell you. The only list that I had was which footy card I wanted next. That was super impressive.
Oh, yeah.
So, Sarah, what was your takeaway from Sarah's story? There were so many things in it for me.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One is there's only one person who cares whether she writes a book or not, and that's her.
Well, I think she said the only person that cares about what she does is her.
Yeah. So, look, just don't complain about it. You want to do it? Don't complain about it. So I thought that was really impressive. The other thing is her relationship with time. There's something she said. You can either view time as I've only got 20 minutes or I've got 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Just a subtle change in the way that you view time. And, you know, she finds 15 minutes before work at the cafe to punch out a few paragraphs. And I think that's really impressive. And I also think the way that she handles pre-worry. Do you pre-worry?
I've got better at it. Like I think I've mentioned on this podcast, you know, I work hard at trying to remain present, right?
Yeah.
By doing mindfulness activities. And so, yeah, look, there's always preemptive thought and thought about what's transpired. But it's a constant trying to work on just going with what's happening in the minute.
And she just decided to stop.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Like, I wish it was that easy for me. It just isn't.
But a great work ethic and, you know, happy to say, well, I don't need to sacrifice one for the other. I am going to do both.
And she did that from a really early age where she said to her mum said, Sarah, you're not going out. You've got too much homework to do.
Are you putting on her mum's voice?
Sorry to Sarah's mum, who I hope has a listen to this. Maybe your voice was a little deep there. But she said, I'm going to do both. So she prioritised the time and nailed her homework and said, all right, I'm out. See ya.
Yeah, but she obviously still struggles to relax and slow down. So I reckon we've got a challenge for Sarah.
What's that?
Well, our next guest in the next episode is the founder and chairman of the Peninsula Hot Springs. I reckon we challenge Sarah to go to the Peninsula Hot Springs and try and relax for 30 minutes.
I think of her own admission, she'd struggle with that.
Maybe. Might be a whole episode in that.
I think there might be. Tell us a little bit about our next guest.
Yeah, so Charles, a pretty amazing career in itself. He sort of didn't intend... Well, he certainly didn't leave school thinking I'm going to start a hot spring, but fell in love with them in Japan. And geez, the amount of patience required to make that happen, especially finding hot water or hot springs in the place that his family had been living for over 100 years. Yeah. Quite amazing.
Yeah, it is an unbelievable story. And it comes back to so many of the themes that we've heard previously. So you're going to hear Charles talk about his passion. And his passion is really about people experiencing nature and everything that there is in life right in that moment of time.
Can't wait for it.
Can't wait for it. So, Doolanders, hope you enjoyed this episode with Sarah Bailey. So much for you to take away from that one. We look forward to talking to you next week.
Bye for now.
Ciao. Hey, Doolanders, if you want to hear more inspiring stories and have this show grow to more and more listeners, do us a favour. Can you like, share, rate and review the Doolander podcast on wherever you get your podcast from?
Wherever good pods are cast.
That's where...